through the Alaska Airlines studios.
This is Tom, Jake, and Stacy on 710 ESPN Seattle. Streaming live on the 710 Sports app and at 710sports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Ross.
Hour number three of Tom, Jake, and Stacy. We're pleased to have in Jake Heaps' chair today, or not today, but right now, one Paul Gallant from the Danny and Gallant Show in the morning. How you doing, Paul?
I'm doing well. I can't throw a football like Jake Heaps.
You don't have to pit yourself out there so soon, man. You can just, you know what I mean? You could just lie. No one knows you like that.
I could throw it over a mountain.
Yeah.
You know what, though? You can wear a Sonic baseball nylon jersey like nobody's business.
Thank you. Yeah, it looks great.
There's a very big market for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, I think I need to get me one of those. Word has it that you've written an article that's going to be up on 710sports.com that talks about the idea that some Seahawks coaches may need to go.
Yeah, so I patched some words together somehow, and it's really about the Seahawks defensive coaching staff. And I'm not necessarily calling for heads. I am more just looking at what has not really happened over the last 3 years. They haven't made any defensive coaching changes the last 3 years. The defense hasn't gotten better. In fact, you could argue it's gotten worse over the last couple of seasons. Now, part of that has to do with some of the changes in personnel. You don't have a Richard Sherman anymore. You don't have an Earl Thomas anymore. Frank Clark's doing his thing in Kansas City as well. But when I look at what isn't happening defensively, there's a lot of young players on this team. Are those young players getting better? Could those young players use maybe better teachers at positions, at positional coaches to maybe get them on the field more quickly, to maybe have them playing at a higher level more quickly? So we're seeing someone like LJ Collier come out of the gates and looking like a first-round pick. So when you have a defense that has had issues and ultimately cost the Seahawks its season, you look at the personnel, but I think you got to look at every single way that you possibly can fix it.
You suggested two names. Do you want to tell us who those two names are and why you picked them specifically?
I will bring up Aaron Glenn first. So Aaron Glenn's someone I've actually had conversations with in the past, and this is a guy that I think when he was in the NFL, he was playing for the Jets, he was playing for the Texans. He was one of the better corners in the league. So we know he could play. Okay, he can play, but what can he teach? Well, this is a guy that's actually had a scouting background at the semi-pro level of football and a little bit in the NFL as well. And this is a guy who now is the secondary coach for the New Orleans Saints. And if you look at the Saints and what the Saints have done over the last couple of years, they brought in some high-end talent, Marshawn Lattimore, and they've seen Marshawn Lattimore turn into one of the better corners in the league.
Except for that one play.
That one did not go so well.
That's okay.
Then you also have, at safety, you have a guy in Marcus Williams, a second-round pick, who has blossomed into a playmaking safety. He had four interceptions this past season. I think Aaron Glenn is a guy that you maybe look at and maybe you bring him in as a secondary coach. Maybe you think about him as a defensive coordinator. I think that guy's got a lot of upside as a coach. And the other name, Ron Miles, who is the Chargers defensive back coach. Here's a fun fact about Ron Miles, other than the fact that he is a Tacoma native and that he played defensive back for the Huskies back in the 80s. This is a guy who was a part of a secondary that, despite a bunch of injuries, helped keep Patrick Mahomes under 200 yards passing, not once, but twice this season. And you got the local ties here. Is that somebody you think about maybe bringing on the staff? I would make a phone call, see what happens.
So are you saying that you're, because I'm not reading you saying either of these guys should be defensive coordinator. You're saying just bringing in some new coaches on defense.
Right. And that could mean being a secondary coach. That could mean looking for guys that have just a different perspective and bringing them onto your defense, and maybe they can bring some fresh ideas to a defense that for the last 2 years has been the exact same coaching staff. Because I think after a while, you can use a fresh set of eyes, a different line of thinking than going with a defense that I know a lot of us have questioned the use of their base 4-3 as much as the Seahawks have. It just seems to be a little bit backwards for 2019, 2020 in the NFL. Why not have somebody look at this, not have that attachment to the system that can propose some alternatives?
I do think it's interesting that the best teacher that they've had on defense in the last 10 years here has been Ken Norton. and the best group of players that they've had recently has been the linebackers. I mean, KJ Wright and Bobby Wagner, they both rave about Ken Norton as a teacher, and we're not talking about a play caller right now, but if they could find that for, say, the D-line or the secondary, I mean, I agree with you there. It's tough to tell. It's like it's a chicken and egg conversation.
Yeah.
Right? Because we always hear Pete talk about these guys' development, and he's, you know, sometimes you need to give them time to develop, and, you know, this guy's working really hard, and some guys develop at different paces than others. And the issue, as far as, I guess, we're concerned, kind of gets muddied up a little bit. It's like, well, is there a different standard for every single guy? Do we look at all the guys? I mean, we look at Trey Flowers and Shaquille Griffin. It took Shaquille Griffin till his third year to really figure it out. Does that mean that I should expect every corner that they ever draft to take 3 years to figure it out, and next year Trey Flowers is going to be really good? Or, like you say, should we bring in maybe somebody with fresh ideas who could maybe get them going a little bit quicker?
Teaching is so important, and I think this is forgotten. We always talk about the head coach. We talk about the coordinators. You don't talk about the positional coaches that much. And, you know, if you've talked to any player, and Stacey, I'm sure in the locker room, like some of the players that you talk to for the Seahawks, they will say a specific coach has really helped them go a long way. I know, having talked to my old co-host in Houston, Seth Payne, he talked about specific assistant coaches who were good and specific assistant coaches who were bad. You want to have somebody in there that can help these guys move along more quickly. And I think right now the big frustration is when you look at a lot of the guys that have been taken in the third round and in the fourth round, the returns just haven't happened. Lano Hill, Tedrick Thompson, it's taken a little bit of time for Rasheem Green to get going. There have been some guys that have been here that you would expect more out of, and it just hasn't happened yet. And yeah, you can address some of these problems by being aggressive and making a big splash in free agency or drafting again. But at the same time, you got to find someone who can fine tune these expensive of pieces of talent. That
you guys think that? And by the way, we're talking to Paul Gallant here, the Danny and Gallant Show. He's got a piece up on 710sports.com about possible changes among the coaching ranks. Do you guys think that Pete Carroll is too patient with players? Do you think that he allows them too much time to develop? I mean, we're fans. We sit here, we watch the games, and we think, man, like, I don't need Trey Flowers to be better next year. I need him to be better right now, because his team is 11-5, and I need him to keep Aaron Rodgers from scoring. Pete Carroll, it feels like he looks at that a different way. Do you guys think he's too patient?
I don't know that he's too patient. I think he is more patient
than a fan.
Probably the average. If there was like a graph of the patience of NFL head coaches, I think he'd be on the far end of patience.
It's a standard joke, but he's still like, hey, CJ ProSize, man. This guy's
but no. But here's what I think. I think that Pete Carroll is a risk taker. And I know that it feels like he's not, because their fourth down attempts. Don't look at it that way. Look at it as Pete Carroll, when he talks about talent acquisition, tries to take risks and think outside of the box. He's used Puna Ford as an example of a guy where he was shorter than the average defensive tackle, came on as an undrafted free agent out of Texas, despite having a great career at Texas, because he was shorter than average, but he had an incredibly long wingspan. I mean, like 8 inches longer than someone his height should have. And that is an example of Pete Carroll finding someone he thinks can succeed in a way that no one else believed in. And I think with those players, he is more patient. If he feels like he has found something that could be the key, right? Think like a fifth round pick in Richard Sherman, a third round pick in Russell Wilson. He feels like if he finds a diamond in the rough, that he will have the patience with that guy. And so with a guy like CJ ProSize, if he's not injured, is their most versatile running back. And one of the more versatile running backs in the league. CJ ProSize has also not been able to stay healthy. But while he's on a rookie contract, Pete Carroll doesn't care. Fine. He's not going to give CJ ProSize a starting spot over Carson just because they drafted CJ ProSize sooner. But knowing the talent that CJ ProSize has, he'll keep him around. And I think in that way, yes, he is more patient than the average guy. If he finds someone that he feels like he believes in, and he's just waiting for the secret thing that he saw to come to light, he'll wait on it. And he doesn't care if fans disagree. He knows that it's there.
Do you think we have a lot of those guys on the team right now? I mean, without going through the roster one by one.
Well, you mentioned the word patience, and you look at guys like Marquise Blair and Ugo Amadi who jump off the screen from an athleticism standpoint, and what's funny is in those situations, you would think that Pete Carroll would, to your, what you've been saying, Stacey, have that kind of patience with letting those guys get out on the field and play, and for whatever reason, he hasn't. And that sort of goes back to, okay, well, why aren't those guys on the field more? Is it because they're doing certain things in practice that they shouldn't? And if they are maybe making a couple of hiccups too many that keeps Pete from bringing them on the field and having that same kind of patience, then is that maybe on the secondary coaching staff? Is that on some of the guys who are down on the totem pole as far as having those guys up to speed and being more trustworthy out
there?
It's
almost like, you know, it's almost like there's two categories we're talking about. Marquise Blair falls into the category of guys who, for some odd reason, are not on the field. I guess the category I was talking about with patience are the guys that are on the field and may not be performing at a standard that is acceptable to, you know, whoever, or isn't even like a league average, but they continue to run them out there no matter what.
Tedrick Thompson, Lando Hill.
Yeah.
Exactly. They run them out there and run them out there and run them out there until they just can't do it anymore.
But it's hard not to justify that when you've done that with guys and it has worked out. Like when you've taken shots on guys and you've just kind of waited for them to blossom and then they did and you felt rewarded for it. So I'm trying to think of an example of, you know, Frank Clark isn't a good example because he didn't really get a chance to start full time until after Cliff Avril.
Jaron Reed was a guy who came on late. When they drafted him, they thought they got a first round talent that had fallen down the board. And he came his first year or two. It was like, not really. And then he really flashed last year.
Efetti might be another one. I know we're not talking offense, but I mean, he's a guy who had all kinds of problems at first. Now, a lot of that, actually, Paul, went back to the coaching staff. Tom Cable. When Cable and Efetti were not a good mix at all. And then when Mike Solari came in, not only did he help out Efetti, but he helped out a couple of other guys too. And that ended up being, at least for that year, the best offensive line they've ever had. So just to circle back to your original point about changes on the coaching staff, we have seen that work here before.
Right.
Yeah, over on the offensive side.
And this is not me calling for any specific person's head, because who would I be, not being a player on the field, not being coached by any of these specific coaches, to say, oh, this guy's not doing the job. Like, I'm not out there actually being taught by these guys. But I would like Pete Carroll to think long and hard if some of the guys that he has on the staff could be doing a little bit more, or if they maybe need a little bit of help, and if maybe that there is somebody out there that he can bring in as just like a consultant of sorts, or maybe someone that could do a little bit more than that, whether it's be another assistant and replace one of the guys that's there, or, you know, and I know as some people have called for, maybe go all the way up and see what's going on with Ken Norton Jr. If maybe there's somebody else there that will be able to get more out of this defense than what we saw, because we needed more out of it when they lost to the Green Bay Packers.
Here's the thing. You always compete.
You do?
What? If you want to win forever, you always
compete. I haven't heard that.
You're not competing. You're not trying.
Coach has got to compete too.
How about somebody to help Pete out at the end of halves?
Well, I mean,
that's a different position. That they need the get talking, back guy that Sean McVay has. They need the hey, like finger snapping 10 seconds left guy.
Right.
I think the whole NFL needs that.
They need the interception guy. When Pete Carroll throws a challenge flag, they need the guy that reaches up to grab it out of the air and haul it back in.
Slaps it back.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, first, I think every team has the get-back guy to get people off the field, right?
Yeah.
Sean McVay just has this personal guy that, like, holds him by the boots, loops, and just, like, back, Sean, back.
Yeah.
No, bad Sean, bad coach.
He needs one of those, like, the backpacks they have for kids that are basically leashes.
Yeah, it's a leash.
Yeah, that Sean McVay can wear, like a little lion backpack, and the tail of the lion is the leash this guy hangs on to.
Before we wrap up with Paul here, what were your thoughts on your first year here? Just watching the Seahawks, differences between
about new perspective.
Yeah, the way the Seahawks are run versus the Texans. You, of course, came from Houston, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, look, they're a lot easier to respect as an organization than the Texans, just based off of the way that they play in the playoff games. I mean, they got off to the slow start against the Packers, and even then at halftime, I never found myself thinking, they're out of this. And that speaks to Russell Wilson. That speaks to just the resilience that this team showed. It was a fun up and down kind of year, I will admit. as someone who is a lover of blowouts, I love blowouts. I love just absolute decimation. It's nice every now and then to see a team just get spanked by the Seahawks, as opposed to thinking a game against a right. Matt Schaub is going to be easy. Thinking a game against a who was the Carolina Panthers quarterback? I don't even remember.
Kyle Allen.
Yeah.
Frankie Fingers, whatever his name
Frankie
was.
Frankie Fingers. Yeah, that was actually, I forgot. It was Frankie Fingers.
Old Frankie. Like, some generic quarterback is all of a sudden leading them on a comeback. I thought it was safe to take a, like, 5-second nap. All of a sudden, it's a close game. It's an exciting team. There's a lot to build off of. I really enjoyed this year, but there's this hollow feeling at the end because they should have beaten Green Bay. Yeah. I feel like they play a 7-game series. I know that's not how the football works, but I think they win that series if it's a 7-game series.
What about, like, of the people you've worked with, who do you think is maybe your favorite?
Very leading question.
Don't take the bait, Paul.
No.
Very leading question.
You know, it's just kind of like an unbiased, just kind of like the first kind of name that comes to mind when you think of, like, the people.
The coolest
Your
person.
New coworkers, like, of the coolest of all of them, maybe the most popular, the best funniest. Dresser, funniest.
You know, definitely Tom Wassel.
Yeah.
You know, Kyle Brown. I like Jake Heaps. You
really?
Know?
Curtis ain't
really?
Bad.
Yeah, Curtis.
I mean a word of it.
Oh, Stacey. Oh, yeah, she works here too.
Thanks for dropping by, Paul.
No problem, guys. Thanks for having
me
on.
Paul's quite the character, isn't he, Stacey?
I don't think he was being very honest in his answer.
You don't think so?
No. I think if Paul's honest with himself, it's very clear which of his new coworkers is the coolest.
You. It's Stacey Joe Ross.
That's who it is, Paul.
Let's just say it once and for all.
Let's be honest with ourselves.
It's Stacey Joe Ross. Hey, we had a little breaking news here. Hey, by the way, our playoff coverage brought to you by Washington Farm Bureau Healthcare. We have a little breaking news here in the last couple of minutes. Remember a couple weeks ago when Neil Peart, the drummer from Rush, passed away? And mm-hmm. I came in on – that was on a Friday. Then I came in on a Monday, and I told you guys that when I went home that night – I cried for like 45 minutes.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm in that same situation right now, but Eli Manning has just announced that he's going to retire. I don't have a reaction right now. Like, Curtis just came in here and asked me how I'm processing this news. This guy's been the quarterback, their quarterback, since 2004. Two Super Bowls, mm-hmm. two Super Bowl MVPs. He had a knack, he had a flair for the dramatic. He was great in comeback situations, just like Russell was, last 2 minutes of the game, etc. He also was famous for, at times, very foolish play, one interception after the other. He was maddening. I know. I don't know how I feel about this right now. I mean, here's the thing. He's already been displaced by
Daniel Jones.
So it's not like he's retiring out of nowhere, and he was the starter last year.
No, but this is your quarterback, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is personal to you. It's not just like news that's hitting you.
I know, but what I'm telling you is, because it's personal to me, my brain, I guess denial is an action right now. Like, I'm not able to really process it and think about it for what it actually means to me, because it's just so sudden.
Is it because you aren't sure yet how you feel about Daniel Jones? I wonder that with people like Patriots fans when Tom Brady leaves, or Saints fans when Drew Brees leaves, if there will be a moment when, depending on the direction you feel like that franchise is moving in, is going to dictate how emotional you get about it.
Look, they're in such dire straits right now. Daniel Jones may be okay. They just hired a special teams coach as their head coach. They just got Jason Garrett as their offensive coordinator. Freddie Kitchens is on the staff. I mean, where are we really going right now?
It could be a cool band of outcasts.
I don't know about that, Stace. I don't know. Right now, let's see what's on tap.
This is What's on Tap with Tom, Jake, and Stacey. So, folks, what's on tap?
You know what we're doing tomorrow? This is going to be fun. We're going to go down to T-Mobile Park for the Mariners pre-spring training luncheon. We're going to be joined by Jerry DePoto and Justin Dunn.
I'm excited.
You know what? If you, and don't get nasty about it, but if you want to tweet either one of us, for questions that you have for Jerry DePoto. I mean, you can get as nasty as you want. I'm not going to read him. I'm not going to ask him any of your smart aleck questions.
Yeah.
Right. But if you're honest to God curious about something.
Yeah, you should.
And Stacey and I think that the question is worthwhile. Let us know at Tom Wassel, at Stacey Jo Ross.
At Stacey Ross.
At Stacey Ross. At Stacey Ross. Yeah.
I'll tweet that out later, too, so we can start collecting some
questions. Yeah, if you have questions for Jerry DePoto.
Scott Service? Are we talking to him?
Well, I don't think we're talking to Scott Service. I think it's just going to be...
For Jerry DePoto, then.
Yeah, or Justin Dunn, if you want to ask questions of him as well. He's a great interview. But that'll be a lot of fun tomorrow. Mariners pre-spring training luncheon. We're going to go read through some NFL headlines next. And I'll try to get my thoughts together on Eli Manning and give you maybe a bit better, like more cohesive answer on that. 710 ESPN Seattle.
You're listening to Tom, Jake, and Stacy.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
Streaming through the 710 Sports app and on 710sports.com.
Now here are your hosts, Tom Wassel, Jake Heaps, and Stacy Rost.
Who is the better Super Bowl tight end? We're going to be going around and asking a couple of questions, NFL questions here, and answering them. We asked Jake Heaps this question before. Travis Kelce or George Kittle? Jake was
Kittle.
Definitely on George Kittle's side here. I think I agree with him.
I do too.
He can do a million different things. For a tight end, he's got speed. He's a little skinnier.
Yeah, but I think he's what you want from a tight end. He can block. He's their lead receiver.
I'm surprised he's as good a blocker as he is with the way he's built. I mean, he's real tall.
Mm-hmm.
But I would think that Kelce would be the better blocker. He's just bulkier.
Yeah. But, I mean, sometimes the bigger guys aren't always better at that. I mean, people are expecting a guy like Jimmy Graham to just automatically be able to do it, but it wasn't really his forte.
I wonder what's the biggest physical asset you have or tool?
As a tight end?
Well, yeah, that would make you a good blocker.
Ooh. Hmm. I feel like that'd be a good question for Ray Roberts.
Yeah, I'm just throwing it out there.
I don't know. Maybe good hands and feet. That would be my guess.
Footwork.
Because I'm thinking of defensive line, and I'm like, well, I wonder if it's kind of similar.
Right.
Being able to kind of, I know he talks about, Ray Roberts talks about kind of the step back being, you know, are they pushing forward? Are they staying there? Or are they taking a step back and spinning in and kind of losing their momentum? Because, you know, you can see the pocket start to collapse and the battle starts, and in like a few seconds you could lose it. So I don't know if there's something about like a center of gravity. We'll have to ask him.
I'll say it. It's a fine art.
It is.
It's a fine art.
I think it's really, really hard to grade offensive linemen and see the success of an offensive line. And they don't get enough credit when they're good.
Yeah.
And they maybe sometimes get too much blame when things fall apart.
Well, speaking of which, Stacey, I'm glad you said it that way. The NFL Network, I guess, has named an unsung hero for every team.
Mm-hmm.
For the Seahawks, I'm just going to say it because you know you have it. It's on the show sheet here. Joey Hunt, my man.
Smart guy.
You know, when was it? I guess it was right after the season ended. I went through and I sent out a tweet about, I just gave out a couple of awards to a handful of different Seahawks. And I think the award that I gave to Joey Hunt was biggest surprise. Some people agree with me, some people didn't. I'm not saying he's all pro or anything like that. But after Justin Britt went down, you're telling me he didn't do at least a serviceable job, like a B-minus job, C-plus?
Yeah, and NBC Northwest said that he also played through a fracture in his fibula, which was in week 9. So that wasn't too long after they lost Britt. So that was through a good part of the season he was playing with that.
Yep.
And then he also dislocated his finger in the playoffs.
Was that compliments of Fletcher Cox?
I think it happened in the Packers game.
In the Packers game.
So that was just one game. But still, I mean, I think there were some concerns, and there have always been concerns that people have. Just when you don't fit into a prototypical size of a lineman, people will always question how you'll hold up. And there were times he lost battles against San Francisco early on in that game in Santa Clara. He had a hard time against Fletcher Cox. He had a hard time. But there were other times he held his own. And it was impressive from someone who was called in to fill in for a regular starter there.
And it's funny, too, because before he actually had to play, What do we remember Pete Carroll saying about him over and over and over again?
Smart.
He's a smart player.
I know. I think red flags always come up when...
Like, uh-oh.
Well, you hear him talk about Jadeveon Clowney, for example, and he... Or even, gosh, who was the player? Oh, Christian McCaffrey. I've never heard Pete Carroll talk about an opponent the way he did about Christian McCaffrey. I was like, he loves this dude. Could not stop talking about all of the attributes he has. So when a coach just says, oh, he's really smart, you kind of get nervous.
It's like, oh, wait a minute. That's the first thing you say about him, meaning he can't do anything physically?
It's like saying, oh, she's got a great personality. You know what I mean? Just like a fun personality. So nice. So nice.
Great personality. Great smile.
Yeah.
Okay, let's see what else we got here. Larry Fitzgerald has bought a share of the Phoenix Suns. Which local team would you want to own a piece of?
Local team? Oh, I think the Sonics would probably be the most, or Sonics, if they would come back, that'd be great. The Seahawks would be the most profitable. I would want to own an NBA team, though. That would be the most fun.
I think I would want to own an NBA team, too.
It sucks that there's not one here.
Isn't the baseball team more profitable, though, than the NFL team?
I just think an NBA team would be fun. Not just because it would be obviously amazing to have one back, but I don't know. It just seems...
I think that's
what I would want.
With the NBA team, it would be easiest to like co-mingle with the players. Because there's only like a dozen of them. You know, you could maybe kind of have that... It would be a smaller family.
Yeah.
Between the coaches, the players, you, the GM. Whereas with the football team, there's like a million guys everywhere.
It would be stressful, too.
Yeah.
I mean, all of it would be stressful, but...
I'll tell you, here's why I wouldn't do baseball. Because it's so much harder to turn a bad team around if you're in that spot.
Yep.
I mean, we know how the baseball draft works, although it seems like teams are getting better at identifying the guys that are actually going to be good at the major league level. That's good. But when it, you know, in the NBA, you make one or two trades, sign a free agent. I think back to the Celtics in 08 when they acquired Kevin Garnett and Ray Allen. They already had Paul Pierce. They made a handful of other trades. Actually, with the Sonics, they turned right around that year and they ended up winning the NBA championship. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can turn it around that fast. NFL.
I don't have the patience for an MLB ownership.
Like a 5-year rebuild?
I think covering it is one thing because you look at all the little pieces. If you were, you know, an owner and waiting for, I don't know, I feel like you'd be impatient.
Yeah. I wouldn't want to watch a team struggle for 3 years unless what I was watching was a bunch of hungry young players who were succeeding relatively quickly. Basically what we're hoping for from the
Mariners. Well, what we'll be talking about this year, right, is development of younger guys. But maybe you aren't watching that day to day if you're the owner.
All right, I said last segment Eli Manning is going to announce his retirement. I've been a Giants fan my entire life, going back to, the first game I ever watched was in 1984. You know why I chose the Giants? My father was watching the game. My father's a lifelong Giant fan. The Giants were playing the Jets. And when I asked my dad, I said, Daddy, who's playing? He says, the Giants and the Jets. I tried to picture which of those two, like, mascots was stronger. Like, what's stronger? What's bigger, a Jet or a Giant? And I sat there. I was like, I guess it depends on the size of the Giant.
It absolutely does. And, like, we know the size of a Jet.
Right. As a 5-year-old, I kind of reasoned my way through that. And I was like, okay, I'm going to be a Giant fan. And
that's how you chose to be a Giant fan?
That's how I picked it. That and also, in the game, I didn't like the Jets' green uniforms. I like the Giant blue.
Yeah.
So that kind of helped too. But that's how I picked them, yeah.
Aww.
True story.
That's adorable.
Fast forward 20 years later, they get Eli Manning,
and now
two Super Bowls.
You're figuring out how to process it.
You know what, Stacey? It's time for this career to end. It really is. I can't watch him out there struggling behind bad offensive line play, no defense. It's just not worth it anymore. The last like 6 or 7 years of his career, he's played okay at times. He's had some very good years, actually. But just watching him get knocked on all over the place, I'm tired of watching it. It's time for this to end. While he's still got, you know, his health.
Were the two Super Bowl wins and Super Bowl MVPs enough to say he was one of the better Giants ever?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the 2011 team is probably my favorite Giant team of all time. The last Super Bowl they won. That was not the most talented team that they had.
Yeah.
But at the end of the year, they pulled together when they needed to. And they beat some teams, a couple of teams, pretty badly that they shouldn't have. They beat the Packers, the 15-1 Packers. They beat them like 37-20 in the divisional round at Lambeau.
Mm-hmm.
They shut out the Falcons at home. It was 24-2, but safety. Then they went into San Francisco, beat a great San Francisco team, and beat the Patriots for a second time. Think about that. His biggest accomplishment is almost unfathomable. He beat Bill Belichick and Tom Brady twice in 4 years on the biggest possible stage. That is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And both times, he had to use a game-saving drive to do it.
I also think that he'll be remembered differently in a couple years. I think that with franchise quarterbacks, people tend to, with time, kind of gloss over the end of their career because few ever have this successful ride into the sunset.
Right.
Like a Peyton Manning, I went out with a Super Bowl win.
Even though he couldn't throw the ball by then, but yeah.
Right, right. And people will never really remember that. They'll think, oh, he went out with a Super Bowl. He was one of the best ever. And maybe the knock will be, oh, I don't know if he was as successful in the postseason as he was in the regular season. But still, it's more often than not, you have a less romantic end to your career.
Yeah.
And I think that will, over time, kind of get glossed over with Eli Manning because it was a not great kind of final stretch, but I feel like that's how it is with a lot of guys.
It's not, you know, some of it's going to be his fault. Some of it isn't, though. They had two of the worst coaches in the history of their franchise in there, and the ownership has admitted that they've screwed it up along the way. So, you know, it's a shame the way it ended, but like you said, most quarterbacks don't get to ride off into the sunset. We ride off into the sunset next. 710 ESPN Seattle.
But wait, it's over.
They're going to wave him in.
It's time to sum it up. With Tom, Jake, and Stacey.
Shot clock turned up.
The final word on everything that matters today in sports. Brought to you by Zone In CBD.
Step back!
Kind of an interesting day, Stacey, in the way that we started the show talking about the Hall of Fame voting and how one person, one brave Hall of Fame voter did not vote Derek Jeter into the Hall of Fame. And, you know, in having that conversation, naturally you think about the career that Jeter had, and it was a long one. He was a good player. He won World Series. And now, in the last 20 minutes or so, we see that Eli Manning will be announcing his retirement. And when you think about these great careers, even if it's Ken Griffey or Edgar Martinez or whoever it is, the way that we remember them as opposed to how they actually were, like, I feel like that's a tough standard to live up to.
It is. I think we often turn the best athletes into these legends that don't have faults or flaws. And I don't know that that's always the best way to remember them. Because on the one hand, sports are about greatness and about seeing people accomplish feats that no one else can do and you can only dream of. And part of the awe that you feel watching them is thinking, I can't believe someone did that when it looked impossible. But I think that sometimes with those greats, you romanticize their career and you ignore the fall off at the end. Or, you know, there's other kind of ugliness with certain careers.
You sure.
Know, maybe they were awful people. But in a lot of cases, for instance, and I'm looking at this with Eli Manning, he wasn't great at the end of his career. And there are other players who kind of dropped off at the end of their career. Maybe you bounce from team to team. I know Eli Manning didn't do this, but maybe you bounce from team to team and you, like an Adrian Peterson. No one is going to say he wasn't one of the greatest running backs, but he didn't get a ride off into the sunset.
No.
And so it's just interesting the way that I wonder in 20 years how we'll look back at that career.
Yeah.
Will we remember the moments where you thought, oh man.
Like he was the great. Yeah, it's like, it's almost like at the end, I don't want to get too dark here, but do you remember your 90-year-old grandmother the way she was when she was in her 60s and 70s? Or do you remember her when she was in her 90s and maybe failing?
Right. But sometimes I think it's because I think about that, too, with people in our lives that aren't always there. And I don't mean to make such an easy comparison, but sometimes you almost wonder, if it is better to remember everything about that because it's a more accurate depiction of the sport. Is it better to look and say the reality of this sport is that in addition to accomplishing greatness, it destroys your body?
Oh, just so you can get a better perspective on
or just
how all this stuff has affected them as,
right,
as people?
Or the idea that they're people, right?
You know, I like that you care so much about athletes as people. That's always, since I've been working with you, that's given me a much different perspective, I think. Like, especially when somebody gets hurt, for example, to think about, you know, it's not just, not that I ever thought of them as like, oh, well, it's just a piece of meat or something. Mm-hmm. But when you think about what a terrible injury just on a given day could lead to for somebody. I mean, it's a big, big deal.
Or the day-to-day injuries. Like when I talked about Lydia and I walking into the locker room and Dwayne Brown had bloody socks and tape all over his hands. And that was just after a game.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Just what you go through on a day-to-day basis even. Why do you think it's important with somebody like Eli or even Peyton, whoever, to remember them, what they were like at the very end, though?
Well,
because in the case of Eli, he struggled at first, and then he was excellent for, I'll give him like 7 years, mm-hmm. 7 years of excellence. And then there was like 5 years at the end where it was not so great, whether it was his fault or not. Why is it important to focus on the end there?
I guess I'm thinking with, I've been watching a lot of Ken Burns baseball, so I think with some of this, I'm thinking specifically of older baseball players because it feels like they set this unattainable goal when in reality they weren't like that consistently. It's just one great thing that happened.
And, yeah.
But that said, I think with Eli, more of what it does is it just brings me to that debate that we were even having earlier in the show with Jeter. What makes a Hall of Famer?
Yeah.
Right? Like, I don't know how many people, if you were to ask them today on the street or on the street in New York, is Eli a Hall of Famer? I don't even know that every Giants fan would say yes.
No.
But if you ask them in 10 years, maybe they turn and they say, oh, well, you know what? Yeah, he was a two-time Super Bowler. And he did oversee their, you know, one of their most successful stretches. And yeah, he did get Super Bowl MVP two times. And yeah, he was one of, you know, when I looked up that stat that only two players have ever been a Super Bowl MVP more than Eli Manning, Joe Montana and Tom Brady.
Right.
It's not an accidental stat, two of the greatest quarterbacks ever. So I think it makes for an interesting conversation about how do we define greatness? How do we choose who gets into the Hall of Fame? There's always going to be one ornery person that doesn't agree, Derek Jeter voter. But I think that's why we talk about sports, right? We come in and we talk about this is why this player is better than this player. But another part of it that's underlying that is saying, this is what this player really meant to this city or this team, and this is why he mattered more. And I think there's other conversations underneath all of that, just besides stats.
I think that every single football fan out there who's not a Patriot fan, who dislikes the Patriots, owes Eli Manning a debt of gratitude. Because in 2007, when that Patriot team was 18-0 going into that Super Bowl, and they had a 14-10 lead. Giants get the ball back. Eli Manning made that throw to David Tyree. That is one of the most foolish throws I've ever seen. I mean, first he eludes the sack somehow. He pumps his feet. He gets out of a couple of Patriot defenders' grasps. And then he looks down the field, not just down the field, but the middle of the field, where there's four Patriot defenders and one white jersey. That lone giant, David Tyree, is like their fifth wide receiver.
But that's why you watch, because those moments, you think, no, this is a movie.
He's their Malik Turner. And he heaves it up, middle of the field, the worst receiver they got, hauls it in, sticks it to his helmet, gets dragged to the ground, spins around, ball doesn't touch the ground. They've got the ball at the 25. Three plays later, it's in the end zone. Away they go. Patriots are 18-1. See if 4 years later we'll do it again.
This is great. A great moment.
I'm going to have to go home and watch some of these highlights.
I think I am too.
I'm going to tear up. Okay, so we're going down to T-Mobile tomorrow. We'll be talking to Jerry DePoto. If you want, text us questions for Jerry DePoto at Tom Wassel, at Stacey Ross. We'll be back on 710 ESPN Seattle.
No good. Oh, this is terrible.
There are going to be ramifications for this going forward.
And it's just no point to it.